Chapter 34. Homosexual Murder. When we consider that homosexuality, like murder, has been known since the dawn of civilization, it seems strange that it's only in the past 100 years or so that the two have come together. Dean Call, the Houston mass murderer, is certainly the worst example of a homosexual killer known to criminal history, although Trotman, Harmon and MacDonald may be regarded as rivals. Before Trotman, who was executed in 1870, the homosexual murderer was almost unknown, or possibly the subject was regarded as so taboo that no one would dare to mention it in any case. Nowadays, moral attitudes have come the full circle. Homosexuality is accepted almost as fully as it was in ancient Greece or Rome. It's true that there's still a large proportion of the population in all Western countries that regards it as wicked, or at least unnatural, but certainly most intelligent people now regard homosexuality as no older than being born left-handed or colourblind. Medically speaking, it's certainly among the most baffling of the sexual anomalies or deviations. It's now unfashionable to refer to it as a perversion. The heterosexual or normal person finds it almost impossible to imagine how anyone could feel sexually attracted to a member of their own sex, and from the biological point of view, this is no doubt just as well. But no one has been able to explain precisely why some men are solely attracted by other men and why some women experience feelings of desire only to a member of their own sex. Freud took the view that homosexuality is the result of incest fear. That is to say, if a boy has no father, or a weak or generally despicable father, he may project all his love onto his mother until the feeling for her becomes unhealthily powerful. Then, out of a subconscious fear of incest, he excludes women from his sex life, because they all remind him of his mother, and he turns to men. This view certainly seems to fit the known facts. A large proportion of homosexual men are fixated on their mothers, and it's rare for a boy with a strong father whom he admires to become homosexual. On the other hand, there's no evidence that a boy who is emotionally fixated on his mother experiences a powerful subconscious fear of incest. On the contrary, many homosexuals kiss and caress their mothers in a manner that suggests they find nothing repellent in the idea of incest. Freud admits that many perfectly normal sons fantasize about making love to their mothers, and that many normal daughters base their notion of an ideal lover on their fathers. The modern Reichian psychologist Robert Ohlendorf takes the view that homosexuality may be formed because the sexual desires of a young child are unusually powerful, and because female objects of adoration are simply unavailable, as is obviously the case in English public schools. On the other hand, there is an equally strong body of informed opinion that believes that homosexuality is an inborn condition, like hermaphroditism, where a man or a woman also possesses some of the sexual characteristics of the opposite sex, so that a man may have breasts or a woman a rudimentary penis and scrotum. Whatever the reason, the moral turpitude theory was long ago exploded. It may be true that a proportion of homosexuals live with a promiscuity that would be unacceptable to most middle-class people, but this is partly biological. Homosexual couples cannot be bound together by children, and partly social, because most homosexuals still feel themselves to be social outlaws to some extent. In many cities, Los Angeles, for example, there are whole communities of homosexuals in which the couples are as stable as any husband and wife. This could be a pattern for the future. The attitude towards homosexuality fluctuates from age to age. Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo seem to have experienced no social ostracism because they were homosexual. Christopher Marlowe, the Elizabethan playwright who was murdered, not only paraded his homosexuality openly, but risked the severe penalties for blasphemy when he stated that Jesus' love of men was physical and not spiritual. But he remained a hero to his cultured contemporaries. By the 19th century, all that had changed. There was a cult of masculinity, and Oscar Wilde spoke of homosexuality as the love that dare not speak its name. The fact that Lord Byron liked Greek boys as much as Italian girls was a well-kept secret until recent years. The self-pitying of Tchaikovsky's music is due in part to the sense of being a social outcast because he loved men. The poet A.E. Housman, the author of A Shropshire Lad, wrote a poem about a man who was condemned because of the colour of his hair, a euphemism for homosexuality. A few men dared to defend it openly. The German Ulrichs wrote a series of pamphlets in praise of homosexuality, but under a pseudonym. Edward Carpenter, Bernard Shaw's friend, declared in print that it was a deeper and nobler form of love than the male-female variety. But most homosexuals kept quiet about it, or even married and maintained a social facade of normality, often at psychological cost to themselves and to their families. This seems to have been the atmosphere that led Jean-Baptiste Trotman to commit his atrocious murders in 1869. The Russian novelist Turgenev, who was opposed to capital punishment, has a moving article describing Trotman's execution in his literary reminiscences. He emphasises his youth, the slender, youthful neck and the childlike gaze, and implies that it's barbarous that such things should happen in a civilised country. But when one reads of Trotman's murders, it's difficult to agree. A young workman, intelligent, proud and rather secretive, he decided to make his fortune and to go to America. He lured a businessman named Kink to Bolvilla in Alsace, poisoned him, like Graham Young, he was obsessed by poisons, and then buried the body under some stones. After this, he lured Kink's family from Alsace to Panting Common near Paris, stopped the cab in the middle of the common, and then stabbed and hacked to death the pregnant Madame Kink and five young children, close to the place where he had already murdered their eldest son. The seven bodies were found the next day, buried under a thin layer of earth. A workman noticed pools of blood under a tree. The pathetic grave contained dolls and children's toys, and the family had been hacked with a spade. The two-year-old had been disemboweled. There were also signs of a sadistic attack on the boy's body. In Le Havre, a gendarme went to ask Trotman a question, and Trotman fled and jumped into the harbour. It was not until they fished him out that the police realised that they had caught the Pantin mass murderer. At first he tried to put the blame on Kink, then, when Kink's body was found, insisted that he had accomplices in the murder. Trotman is a strange psychological study. He was the youngest of a large, poverty-stricken family, adored by his mother, not much liked by his brothers. His father, a bitter, overworked man, was an inventor who had seen others reap the reward for his invention of an appliance used in weaving. He was, in fact, ineffectual. Trotman himself was an outsider at school, and when he went to work at 14, the other workmen made his life hard. His brother Edward was one of his chief tormentors, and one day, without warning, Trotman struck him violently in the face with a hammer. From then on, he was left alone. He achieved a brief popularity when he saved a workman's life by tearing his hand out of some machinery, but it didn't last. He hated his poverty, and he dreamed of making himself and his mother rich. In many ways, he deserved sympathy. He was intelligent, sensitive, too good for his poverty-stricken background. His response was to develop a blind hatred of the world and a determination to be rich at all costs. The savagery with which he hacked the Kink family reveals that he felt no bond of human sympathy with them and detested their normality. And this Trotman syndrome can be found in a large number of homosexual murders. It seems highly probable, then, that the same causes are at work: the sense of being an outsider, the hatred of people who seem to be happy and comfortable in the world. Anyone who's known cultured homosexuals will know that many of them have an irritating tendency to insist that all the greatest men of genius were homosexuals. Plato, Michelangelo, Shakespeare, although many historians agree that he was not, Tchaikovsky, and so on. Like militant Negro movements in America, homosexuals often respond to the feeling of rejection by insisting that they form a kind of elite, the gay equivalent of Black is Beautiful. When this overbalances into violence, it's like a volcanic upsurge of hatreds and resentments. It's difficult to know how to begin to understand the motives of Fritz Haarmann, the butcher of Hanover, who at the end of the First World War made a living out of picking up youths at the station with an offer of a night's lodging, killing them and then selling their bodies for meat. He may have been egged on by his lover, Hans Granz, a petty thief and pimp, and there can be no doubt that both committed sexual attacks on the youths. Haarmann is believed to have killed more than 50 victims, so he probably qualifies as the world's record holder for mass murder. A cheerful, fat little man, he was gay and irresponsible at his trial, and seems to have been liked by the police officers. Even his insistence that he killed his victims by biting them through the throat did not seem to decrease his popularity. In prison, before he was beheaded, Haarmann produced a confession explaining that he took enormous pleasure in sexual perversion and torture. In this respect, he seems to resemble Dean Call, the Texas homosexual child killer. The case of the Cleveland torso killer, who dismembered and decapitated a dozen victims, mostly men, in the mid-1930s, has already been discussed in the chapter on headless corpses. Although he was never caught, circumstantial evidence makes it certain that he was homosexual. And the strange case of the homosexual mutilator who terrorised Sydney in Australia in the early 1960s provides some interesting parallels with the crimes of the Cleveland murderer. Like the mad butcher of Kingsbury Run, he preyed on deadbeats and down-and-outs. The history of the case begins on July the 4th, 1961, when an old man discovered a blood-stained corpse behind the dressing sheds of the Sydney Domain Baths. Forensic examination revealed that the man, identified as Alfred Greenfield, had been stabbed 30 times. The killer had hacked off his genitals and seemed to have made an attempt to cut off the head. 5 months later, on November the 20th, another body was found in a public toilet at Moore Park, a suburb of Sydney. The same mutilations and stabbings revealed that the killer was a sadist who had wielded the knife in a frenzy. The presence of the body in a toilet suggested that the victim and his killer had gone in together for sexual purposes. The dead man was identified as William Cobbin. The police launched an enormous manhunt for the mutilator, as the papers were soon calling him, but it was impossible to patrol all the areas where the killer might strike. It happened again 4 months later. This time the victim was still alive when he was found. He was Frank McLean, about 30 years old, and he had lost too much blood to be able to talk. He died soon after he was found in Little Bourke Street, Darlinghurst, not far from Moore Park. On November the 19th, 1962, the Deputy Health Inspector of the Council visited a house at 71 Burwood Road, Concord, to investigate a smell the neighbours had complained about. Underneath the building, at the back, they found another mutilated body. A cleaning mark in the sleeve of the coat gave the police a lead, but checking it was a long business. The house, which was a shop, had been purchased in October 1962 by a man named William MacDonald, who had not been seen since early November. It looked then as if the murdered man was probably MacDonald, but doubts arose when the postal authorities reported that one of their employees, a man named Alan Brennan, had also not been seen for some time, and that he had given his address as 71 Burwood Road. Perhaps the dead man was Brennan. It was under this name that the corpse was buried. But when the police traced the shop that had cleaned the jacket, they came up with yet another name, Patrick Hackett. This raised an interesting question in the minds of some of the detectives on the case, for in the house, together with a blood-stained pillow, they had found two paperback books, one on Jack the Ripper, the other a novel called Ritual in the Dark by Colin Wilson, dealing with a homosexual mass murderer. Clearly these were part of the library of either William MacDonald or Alan Brennan. And then on Monday, April the 22nd, 1963, came the break in the case. A workman strolling along George Street suddenly recognised a man who was walking past him. It was Alan Brennan, who was supposed to be dead. He told the police, and a hunt for Brennan began immediately. Identical pictures were circulated. 2 weeks later, two clerks at the Spencer Street Railroad Station in Melbourne thought they recognised Brennan. He was working as a station assistant. The police were informed. The man's birth certificate bore the name David Allen, but the police had no doubt that this was the killer they wanted. They took Alan in for questioning, and he soon admitted that he was the former tenant of Burwood Road and that his name was really William MacDonald. Like the English sex murderer Christie, his great mistake had been to leave a corpse behind on his own premises and then flee. In his room in Melbourne, police found a copy of an Encyclopedia of Murder by Colin Wilson and Pat Pittman. Asked why he wanted to read such rubbish, MacDonald replied, "It's the only thing I get any pleasure from." MacDonald alleged that he had been sexually assaulted by an army corporal when he was 15 years old. This was in England. And ever since that time, he had been tormented by a compulsive desire to kill. He had picked up his last victim, Patrick Hackett, at the People's Palace Hotel when Hackett was drunk and invited him back to the house for a drink. His intention was to kill him. In the middle of the night, when Hackett was asleep on the floor, MacDonald got out of bed, got a knife and began stabbing him in a blind rage, as he said. He cut his own hand badly and had to go to hospital to have it stitched, claiming he'd cut himself on a bread knife. Yet the compulsion to kill remained as strong as ever. A few weeks later, he went out looking for another victim in Sydney and went to the suburb of Redfern, hoping to murder a Russian acquaintance. Luckily, the man was not at home. Brennan then decided to move to Melbourne. Three psychiatrists decided that he was a paranoid schizophrenic. He was found not guilty on the grounds of insanity and committed for life to the Morissette Mental Home. MacDonald and the Cleveland Killer preyed on tramps and deadbeats. Some homosexual killers have been tramps themselves. For example, Adolf Seefeld, executed in Germany in 1936 at the age of 65. He had been killing boys since 1908, and a curious feature of the crimes was that he used a poison he concocted from toadstools and fungi, and that the victims were all found in an attitude of repose with no obvious sign of sexual assault. He confessed to a dozen murders of boys between the ages of 4 and 11, two of them on the same day in October 1934. Karl Panzram, the mass murderer, was also a tramp and a deadbeat, and many of his murders were apparently committed purely for the pleasure of killing. Murders committed by female homosexuals are relatively rare, but there is one case that certainly ranks in horror with any of those discussed above. On May the 11th, 1961, a schoolteacher driving through Peterskin, Ogden Park, Oregon, looked down into Crooked River Canyon and saw what she thought to be two dolls. A ranger went out to investigate and found them to be the bodies of two children, a girl aged 4 and a boy of 6. The genitals of both had been mutilated with a knife, and the girl had been alive when thrown into the canyon. The publicity led to a phone call from a woman in Eugene, West Oregon, who said that they could be the children of a neighbour, Gertrude Jackson, who had lived in the area with a mannish young woman named Janice Freeman. They had left the area in a red Mercury car 2 days before the bodies were found. A description of the car was so accurate that the police soon found it in a used car lot in Oakland, California. The dealer had the address of the woman who had sold it, Gertrude Jackson. The women had left the apartment, but the police arrested them when they returned to pick up some old clothes. Gertrude Jackson, aged 33, immediately confessed to the murder of her two children. Her husband had left her, and she had been seduced by 21-year-old Janice Freeman. Janice was the boss. Her word was law. She wanted me to walk around the house naked all the time, but I couldn't do it in front of the children. It was, again, a relationship of total dominance, like so many that have led to murder. Janice, a tough-looking delinquent girl, admitted, "I'm the butch." She had hated men ever since, as a 4-year-old child, she had been raped by a young boy who had been left in charge of her while her mother went shopping. The relationship with Gertrude Jackson was ideal. Gertrude was a low-dominance female who adored being bullied and ill-treated. The only trouble was the children. Janice apparently had no difficulty persuading Gertrude that they would have to die. On May the 10th, at Crooked River Canyon, Gertrude had gone for a walk while Janice strangled the boy, Larry, and then mutilated his genitals with a knife. When Gertrude came back, she helped Janice undress the 4-year-old girl, mutilate her genitals, then toss her over the cliff, still alive. Mrs. Jackson pointed to the blood on Janice's hand. Janice said, "Yum, yum," and licked it off. They then kissed and hugged in the car. Both women were sentenced to life imprisonment. The sheer violence and brutality of such murders is a puzzling feature which is still not fully understood. But it should not be taken as an argument that homosexuals are more violent or cruel than other people. In fact, considering the large number of homosexuals, statistics show that as a group they are less violent than the rest of the population. From the criminologist's point of view, it will be interesting to see whether, as homosexuality becomes more socially acceptable, this sadistic and violent feature of so many homosexual murders will diminish. At present, all the evidence suggests that it will.